It is April 15th, tax day. It is 9:30. Apologize for the lateness of the meeting. We have a number of bills to cover today. We're going to, and just for the members' information, tonight we're going to meet at 4 for the operating budget. Right now we have 326, which is wastewater discharge program. That is a bill sponsored by Senator Terrio as his staff. Oh, hi, Zach. I didn't see you there.
Chairman.
Oh, you know, by the way, present at the table, we have Senator Wilkins, Senator Ward, Senator Lehman, Senator Olson, Senator Hoffman, Senator Osterman, Senator Green, myself, Senator Kelly. Senator Osterman, you had a question?
I will not be here tonight. I've got a memorial service.
Okay, if you could just let
what the... What time will the meeting be?
It's at 4 o'clock. You could just let the co-chair know.
Oh, I can be here for part of it.
So maybe we can start it.
It's not till 5:30.
5:30 it starts.
If you could just let Senator Donnelly know, he'll be chairing that meeting. Good morning, Zach. How are you?
Morning.
Go ahead and present your testimony.
Good morning, Senate Finance. I would like to thank you, first of all, for hearing Senate Bill 326. My name is Zach Warwick. I'm staff for Senator Terrio, who's sponsoring this bill. Basically, this bill directs DEC to evaluate the benefits and consequences of assuming NPDES primacy. NPDES is the pollutant discharge permitting process that's currently administered by the EPA out of Seattle. When the federal government enacted the Clean Water Act of 72, they provided that states can be authorized to administer their own NPDES permitting program. Currently, 44 states and the 44 states in the Virgin Islands administer their own program. In Idaho, their equivalent of DEC is currently producing a report and giving it to their legislature to see if it's in their best interest as well. The major reason the states currently administer the programs is to allow tailoring to specific environmental features and allow states to decide how timely the permits need to be issued. Basically requires the DEC to evaluate the possibility of administering the program, as well as describe the costs and outline possible sources of funding from the federal government. Basically, the next logical step in the overhaul of the DEC permitting process. I'll be able to answer any questions. I also believe that Tom Chappell with DEC is online to testify, as well as several people from the Producers Council.
Thank you. Are there any questions of the testifier? Senator Osterman?
We have before Eastern Environmental Court I'm wondering how in-depth the sponsor has gone to see what the difference is or what potential problems can be created by adopting.
Senator Osman, through the chair, I don't know specifics of problems. I know that there are some people in the state of Alaska, you guys are probably aware, that think that the EPA does a better job of permitting than DEC, but I'm not aware of any specifics.
Senator Osterman?
Well, if you read the bill, in the title, it starts relating to evaluating state assumptions, and the planning of purpose to direct it to evaluate the potential benefits and consequences. But then it gets into Section 2, and it lays out all the statutory and regulatory changes, procedures for issuing permits, procedures for conflict, statement of cause. I'm wondering, are we actually asking them to go through the whole process of doing statute and regulatory changes and drafting all those changes before we see something in black and white that shows the evaluation of the differences, or is this supposed to be the evaluation?
Senator Osterman, through the chair, I think it kind of, it goes in stages. They would originally evaluate and see whether the process would be good for the state. If it's obviously not going to be a good thing for the state of Alaska, I would imagine they wouldn't go through and create the statutory and regulatory changes and all the rest of the things that they're asked to do.
Further questions, Senator Osterman?
Maybe somebody from the department has those answers.
Okay. Mr. Chapel, in at the Anchorage LIO, go ahead. We can, Mr. Chapel, we can barely hear you here. If you could get a little closer to the microphone.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, can you hear me now?
You're better, but go ahead.
Okay, I'll speak up as loud as I can. Apparently the mic's a little weak today.
All right.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tom Chapel. I'm the director of the Air and Water Quality Division at DEC. And I just want to make a couple notes about this bill. Senator Osterman asked how in-depth this work is going to be. I wanted to relay that that question to say that this issue has been discussed on and off for about the last 15 years in Alaska, and indeed the state of Idaho is doing the same thing that we're proposing here. The question has arisen before as to whether it's in the state's best interest to take on this permitting program. And as we had a stakeholder work group over the last couple of years talk about this issue, the industries in Alaska and local governments and others involved in this have really said that it's impossible to tell at a cursory level whether this will be beneficial or not. And that's the same issue that Idaho came up with, is that until you lay out much of the detail, it's hard to tell whether there is a strong benefit for the state involved. And so, in fact, that's the purpose of this bill, would be to lay out the details so that all Alaskans can take a hard look at that, the legislature can have a hard look at that, to decide whether there's really enough benefits here for the state to pursue it. So, consequently, Idaho and what we're proposing here thought that the best way to do that is actually get to the point of drafting some regulations and permitting procedures and the proposed statutes that would go with it. That's the way you tell whether it would be beneficial or not. Now, as Zach has said, if it's obvious fairly early on that there is not a benefit, then likely we would curtail the effort. But the issue has been brought up a number of times, and it is a complex issue, and it will probably take a fairly decent level of inquiry here with going to the level of regulations, or at least what would regulations look like, to really be able to answer the question of, is it in the best interest of the state of Alaska? So I think that's basically what I wanted to say, Mr. Chairman, and I'd certainly be willing to answer any questions the committee might have.
Thank you, Mr. Chapel. Senator Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On page 25 of the report, of the Easton report, it says that 174 general and individual permits, and that 37 of them have not been extended. Can you give me a breakdown of what industries the other 137 are that have been administratively extended?
Through the chair to Senator Ward, I'm sorry, I don't have the Easton report in front of me.
Okay, I'm sorry, I got the wrong person then.
Mr. Sund, is it?
Yes.
Go ahead. Present your testimony.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. My name is John Sund. I'm vice president of Northwest Seafoods, a company we started in Ketchikan in 1981. And we have seafood processing plants in Ketchikan, Petersburg, Cova, Chignik, and two floating vessels that process crab and herring throughout Alaska, and salmon in Bristol Bay in southeast Alaska. And we have NPDES discharge permits for each vessel and shore plant, and have dealt with the NPDES permitting system for the last 20 years. And I would testify in favor of the bill, and just a couple of points on where I see this this issue going. The current status of NPDES is that it's jointly administered basically by EPA and DEC. And for the permit holder like us, we have to file joint reports and duplicate copies of all reports, one to the EPA office in Seattle and one to the DEC office in whichever district you are in Alaska. When we have issues with the discharge, we have two phone calls to make, one to each one. So there's joint administration here. I think what this bill is after is to say, can we take the administration of the permit and put it under one roof, and that roof being DEC in Alaska. We're not going to change the terms of the permit by doing this. All of the terms and conditions would stay the same, but what we would get is a more uniform interpretation and enforcement of the standards by knowledgeable people who are living in the state. We could get around some of the compliance discretion we have. For example, Mr. Chappell, DEC and EPA and some of the seafood industry have been trying to get together occasionally to understand the current permit and get some of the discrepancies of the permit ironed out. And what we've discovered is a lot of the EPA people in Seattle who are in charge of enforcing this permit, administering the permit, and the compliance have never been to Alaska. They don't know much about our state. They know very little about our industry, how much the difference between a salmon-producing plant that has high volume in one port of the year versus a year-round seafood plant. So we get lots of just issues of people who don't know much about what their the permit is enforced for and what they're actually looking for compliance. The second issue we get is interpretation issues. The water quality standards are national standards, but water quality is interpreted by the state, and we have several issues. What are the water quality standards? Mixing zones, how big are they, where are they, how are they? And in our world, zones of deposit that we get for depositing seafood waste on the bottom of the ocean are actually state issues. The actual bottom of the ocean is a state issue. The quality of the water is a federally set issue, and mixing zones are state issues. And so when we talk to the state and we say, hey, we got this issue and that issue, they'll say, well, that's a federal, that's an EPA issue. And we go to EPA, and EPA says, well, yeah, but that's the state issue, and the state does this. So, you know, we get ping pong balls back and forth, and we're just trying to bring them all together and kind of get an ongoing education process of who we are and what the permit means to us and how we would like to know how it's going to be interpreted and what we have to do to comply with it. We want to stay in compliance. Being out of compliance is very expensive. So I kind of look at this as a good process in answer to Senator Osterman's question, is this a good way to go? Well, the devil is usually in the details, and in this case, it's really in the details. And I think until we can see what a statutory and regulatory framework would look like, it's hard to say, is it in the best interest of the state of Alaska to take over this permit? And is it in the best interest for the industries that are going to be under and regulated under this permit to get it all under one roof? You know, sometimes it's an advantage to be under two roofs, but in the last 15 years I've been involved with this permit, I haven't seen any advantage to that side of it. So it's I think this gives us a way to look at it, to get a peek at what something might, the road might look like, a roadmap going down, and say, hey, this is a journey we want to go on. And then who's going to fund it? And I think that's an important question there, that the funding of the administration of this permit, currently the federal government funds their side of it. And I think that's a big issue that we need to deal with. But until you get get it all mapped out, we're not going to know where it goes. So I would testify in favor of it, Mr. Chairman, and you could take any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions of the committee? In Fairbanks, Mr. Jeffers.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Bill Jeffers. I'm a manager of environmental services for Fairbanks Gold Mining Inc. and vice president of the Council of Alaska Producers, which is an organization that represents the major mining companies that do exploration and mining in Alaska. We're in favor of this bill, and I think to keep this short, I would say that Tom Chappell characterized what the water quality work group that was put together a couple years ago was our primary mission, and I think Tom did a good job of voicing our concerns about the pros and cons of this whole program and taking a good hard look at it to see which is the best for Alaska industry. And I think some of the previous testimony reiterated some of the concerns and problems that we've had in the past. I'll just leave it at that, and if anybody has any questions.
Are there any questions at the table, Mr. Jeffers? Thanks, Bill. No questions. Charlie, Mr. Bodie.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Charlie Bodie. I work with Usabelli Coal Mine here in Fairbanks, vice president of governmental relations. Here this morning to speak in favor, passing committee substitute for Senate Bill 326, the statement that was offered by Senator Terrio Olson. One of the problems that at least the mining community for probably a decade and a half, that there has always been a tremendous backlog of the permitting coming out of Region 10 in Seattle, which is where all of us might go to file the applications for the NPDES permits. It would seem to me that because our industry is basically a dynamic and not a static industry, that certainly as we change the areas that we're mining in and whatever, that we can certainly take into consideration the timeline that it's going to take you 3 to 5 years water discharge permit, but it would be I guess a little more or a little less unsettling if more of a certainty, and again, as others have testified, if we had from the state of Alaska who had dealt with issues in the state rather than trying to train an ever-changing staff at Region 10 of Seattle. I think that in the past, as we've discussed whether or not the assumption of this or taking primacy was a good idea, the answer was always the same. No one knew until such time as we take us. This legislation gives us a chance to take a serious look at it, and then we can all, from a base of knowledge, make a decision as to whether or not it's in the state's best interest to assume the program. That concludes my.
Charlie, we lost you there. Can you hear us?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
That concludes my testimony, Mr. Chairman. I'd answer any questions.
All right. Thank you. Senator Osterman.
Yeah, thank you. A thought just crossed my mind. Mr. Booty, do you, is there a fee for your permits, EPA permits? You have to pay EPA per fee?
Senator, we do not spend money on the NPDES permit. We currently pay anywhere from $3,000 to $6,000 for the state to certify the permits that, in fact, what we've presented will not impair water quality within the state of Alaska, but there is no fee associated with the federal side of the permit.
Thank you.
Charlie, this is Pete. Is this time critical? Is this something that needs to be done now, or is it something we could maybe wait a year to do?
My personal opinion is it's not time critical. A year would not make a difference.
Would that be your estimate as well, Bill?
Yes.
Thank you. Any other questions, Senator Osterman?
No, that's fine, thank you.
All right. Questions or comments from the committee? Senator, welcome to that. Oh, I thought you had your hand up.
Is that the end of the testimony?
Yes, it is.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Lehman.
Mr. Chairman, I'm just going to say right off that I've worked quite a bit in this area in my professional life. And my general reaction is in agreement with those who testified today that we'd be better off to have the management of this whole permit process in the state than with EPA. But I'm, you know, right now I'm looking at the fiscal note and sort of the approach of getting there and wondering why it takes, in this plan, a year and a half to get to a plan. I mean, I understand the need to get stakeholders involved, and I think that process is important. But I'm not really sure, and I've told the department this when we've discussed it, why it makes sense to hire a full-time, temporary, non-permanent environmental specialist for, presumably somebody who's not familiar with this process, and then an environmental specialist 3, and hire them for a year and a half, and then along with some contractors go through this process. I suspect it's to engage the stakeholder community and, you know, and go through this process, but it just seems to me that we could have a better way of getting there, a faster way, one that costs us less money and maybe accomplish the same goals. But anyway, that's my concern.
Senator Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm not quite sure who to ask, but I had noticed in the report that it was varying amounts among the other states that have already taken over this function, where the program receipts were supplying from 96% of the appropriations that were needed to operate it at the state level, 94%, 60%, 57%. And that is one of the reasons why I had requested to know which one of the, what category were the permits that were extended administratively were, so that I can maybe start to balance together this in a picture so that I can understand it. Right now, my understanding is that they, the federal government is administratively extending permits out of 174 for 137 of them, and they've issued 37 permits. So I think I'd like to know who are these, what type of industries are being extended and for what periods? It says 5 years, there's a fall-off point of 5 years, but there must be, since this program's been around since 72, there must be some kind of formula that has been in effect and have been working with this extension process.
Mr. Chappell, could you comment on Senator Ward's question? Do you have a comment on that?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman, Senator Ward. Although I don't have the Easton report in front of me, it has been common that EPA out of Seattle has administratively extended permits. And that results because each permit has a 5-year life. At the end of that 5 years, not been able to take up and devote resources to renew it at that time, then they administratively extend them. And Region 10, a few years ago, Congress put all of EPA regions on a call back to say there's too many delays going on. And in fact, Region 10 was one of the worst. In Alaska, we had, for example, the Anchorage Municipal Treatment Plant at Point Warrensop had been administratively extended more than 10 years without a permit renewal. Many of the larger industries in Alaska with seafood, mining, and others were extended. Over the last 2 years, EPA of Seattle has caught up on many of those and has now whittled that list down to, I think it's in the range of 10 to 20 perhaps. But it's been a common tool, Senator Ward, that they will administratively extend a permit if they don't have the resources to get at the renewal right away.
And Mr. Chairman, if I might, would you be able to give me I noticed several different categories in here, mining, seafood processing, couple oil, what the bulk of those permits are?
Through the chair, Senator Ward, the NPDES permit basically address any discharge to surface waters. Now, EPA has what they call a major source and a minor source breakout. Under the major source, you're looking at sewage treatment plants for all of our moderate, even our smaller communities, say Yakutat, Ketchikan, Cordova, Soldotna. Those are all what EPA calls major discharge sources. So we have almost all of our medium to larger communities in Alaska have an NPDES permit that has been administratively extended over time. Then we have our major industries that are regulated by this, include our mining activities, our seafood processing, our oil and gas. For example, all the cooking lift platforms operate under a general permit that EPA issues to cover all of those platforms. North Slope activities have both individual and general permits. So it is those industry categories that constitute the major sources that are regulated by this permit program.
Mr. Chairman, since this is not one of the budgets that I work on a subcommittee level, maybe the subcommittee chair of that who's next to me could tell me, is the amount of fees that are being collected for permits, what is that percentage as compared to the current cost of this? Or does anybody know that? Because I noticed that in some of these they have $80,000 for a pulp mill permit, and in that particular case it's supplying 96 program receipts are supplying 96% of the program.
I don't have the numbers at my fingertips, but it's, and Tom Chappell, who's online, probably has a better source of numbers. But my understanding is that the fees would have to be increased to generate these additional revenues. Is that correct, Tom?
Through the chair, Senator Lehman, one of the major pieces of this work would be to look at how it should be funded.
Right.
As Senator Ward looked at the report from Easton Consulting, several states funded with a combination of program receipts. Some states funded predominantly with program receipt fees. Other states funded partially with state general fund dollars or federal dollars. So our work, if this were to move forward, would be to examine how other states run it financially, and there certainly would be to examine whether we can acquire any funding, federal funding funds, to help offset the cost of running this program.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I kind of want to get this straight. Essentially, the program that we have now, you don't pay for permits per se for an NPS and PDES permit. You pay a fee for certification to the DEC. If we were to switch to primacy, it is assumed that the permits that we're then going to be getting from the DEC will have a cost associated with them, and then I assume maybe even on top of that you'd have the certification. Maybe not. That would have to be worked out. I guess you wouldn't need the certification if the DEC gave the permit anyway. I guess that's that's what we're looking at in the future if we do this, Mr. Chappell.
Mr. Chairman, I believe yes, that you wouldn't have two fees. If the state was doing the entire job, there would be a fee for the permit. Now, it may well be that the fee would be higher than what the current certification fee is, but until the work is laid out and we know what the costs are and the options to fund it, we really won't know what the fees would be.
Yeah. Okay. Senator Osterman.
On page 54 and 55, it talks about, of the Eastern Report, it talks about, particularly on 55 in this first sentence, it says, with 10 full-time equivalents in DEC currently working under the NPDES, then it talks about DEC or EPA 23 full-time. And then there, I guess it looks, if I read this correctly, we're talking about if the state DEC would end up with 14 to 29 full-time. So obviously, somewhere along the way, that's going to have to be paid for. And obviously, no, and the bill itself, under the statement on page 2, it asks for a statement of the cost, assuming the primacy, and then a statement of sources of federal funding available. So obviously, the report would come back and tell us whether the feds are going to pay for any of this or whether the industry is going to have to pick up the whole burden of going from 10 to possibly 29 full time. And as Mr. Bowie said, you know, he doesn't pay a federal fee, but he pays the state $3,000 to $6,000 already. So I'm just wondering whether his bill's going to go from not paying the feds anything, paying the state $3,000 to $6,000. State 6 to 9. I those kind of questions obviously have to be answered.
R50,000. Any other questions or comments from the people online? Senator Lehman.
I'd just say that I would hope, you know, if this proceeds, that there would be some efficiency realized, you know, in the whole NPDES process. If we look at you know, the EPA's current, or whenever it was, when this report was written, of 13 added to the state's 10, and just extending that and say, well, we'll keep 23. We really haven't developed any efficiency, but I assume with a reduced interaction with the EPA that, you know, we can just do this a lot better. And if we can, then I think that's where the benefit comes. Well, that's another benefit in doing this program. And obviously, the real benefit is having Alaskans here in this state and making these decisions under the state under a state program. But an ancillary benefit should be in a combined system, a permitting system. We should realize some benefits of not having to essentially duplicate things with a whole other staff. And I would hope that if, you know, if this does go ahead, that is going to be a very real goal. A major goal would be to have substantial efficiencies. But I agree with the others testified that, you know, especially with our challenges with general funds, it's likely if we were to do this that the regulated community is going to end up picking it up, or I guess depend on Uncle Ted dollars to, you know, for at least the near future to deal with it.
I'll call brief. Oh, I'm taking the news just for a moment.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with Senator Lehman anymore. I mean, you would assume that putting it together would give you an economy of scale and efficiencies that you would hope would come out of it. although the recommendations in this report on page 60 go right to the point, you know, more accessible, more predictable. But it also, third line down there says, you know, the industry shall be requested to contribute financially. Industry components shall be accomplished through a permit fee. And obviously, we've seen how the permit fees go, everything from permitting a restaurant inspection to what we've seen jumping 300 or 400% over the last couple of years, and how we handle our budget and force the departments into these situations. The other thing is, in all due respect to the Department of DEC, when you start talking about building bureaucracies, and the department is the one that's going to put the plan together, and come back and show us how it's going to work. And if the department really wants this, we'll come back with a very favorable report. So I'm a little concerned on that aspect of protecting the industry and what's going to cost in the long term. I totally agree with the way that Senator Lehman portrayed the, you know, getting more accessible, and also the testifiers that have testified today. I just hope they know what they're going to get. You know, we're going to spend $315,000 in the next year and a half to get this report, so I hope it's something that they can live with.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, if I could just comment on the former senator's evaluation of DEC and working with DEC over the past number of years before I became a legislator, I was certainly positively impressed with the way they went and handled, handled some of the difficulties that we had out there, especially in Diomede, where I worked with the core people that were there from Fairbanks. And so I think that that positive experience before I became a legislator has carried over to being involved with them now that I am in the legislature. But going on with a comment that Senator Lehman talked about, where we're dealing with two different entities and trying to get permits, and I think it was voiced by one of the candidates or by one of the witnesses already, that last thing we want to do is to continue encumber development by making it where one person goes to one office, they say no, it's not somebody else's office, and back and forth. Having tried to get permits in the past before, it's been very, very aggravating to not have anybody take a responsibility. So if you could put it into one place, one area, get that permit. There were times, you know, where I didn't really care what the financial burden was that I had to carry. I just wanted that permit because the construction time was so short and had other things pressing on me. And so just to encourage reasonable development, you know, I think we should try and make it as efficient as possible. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator. Any other questions or comments? I want to try to just do a conceptual amendment on this bill, and that would be to change the effective date in Section 3 of the bill, where it says immediately I would like to change that to January 1, 2003. And the line 12, starting in line 10, it says the final plan shall be submitted to the legislature on the first day of the second regular session of the 23rd Alaska State Legislature. I'd like to change that to 24th Alaska State Legislature. And then, of course, change the fiscal notes. Senator Lehman.
Mr. Chairman, the first one, I understand it makes sense. The second change, it's the first day of the second regular session of the 23rd legislature, which means the next legislature, 1 year into it, so halfway through.
They'd have a year, you're
right. Right, so if we would leave it, then they would have a year.
Sure.
And it's under, and I just want to make sure you understood what you're doing. So I think you meant the first part, and not, you didn't really mean the second part.
Didn't you?
Well, I don't.
Right, you're right. You're
I don't
right.
think so. I think no, you. You're right. I think you intended for them to have a year instead of a year and a half.
That's correct. Okay. A year would work.
So, just for
clarification, final plan shall be submitted to the legislature on the first day of the second regular session of the 23rd Alaska State Legislature. That would stay the same, and the effective date would be January 1st, 2003. Is that what you're saying, Senator Lehman? Clarification.
Right.
Do you have that, Robin? All right. Is there objection to that amendment? Hearing none, amendment number one is passed.
So in fact, the fiscal note timing would remain the same. And because your first, the first portion of your first legislature. Take brief videos. The fiscal note then for 03 could be cut in half. And then move that portion out to 04 for the 96,000 in 04. Do the members understand the fiscal note? Are there objections? Hearing none, the fiscal note has been amended as well. You did that, Rob. Okay. Any other questions or comments on the bill? Zach, I see you back there with kind of a deer in the headlights look. We called your boss before we did that, just to let him know. So you don't have to go back and give him the bad news. Any other questions or comments on the bill? Will the committee?
Chair, will move to report the finance version of the bill with individual recommendations and the accompanying revised fiscal note.
Are there objections? Senator Ward, you wish to speak to your objection?
I don't understand enough about it to spend $100,000 in general fund right now. I'm not comfortable with the effect of it.
Senator Green? Senator Hoffman?
Yes.
Senator Lieben?
Yes.
Senator Olson?
Yes.
Senator Ward?
No.
Senator Wilkins?
Yes.
Senator Altman?
Yes.
Senator Donnelly? Senator
yes. With that, SB 326 has been moved from committee with individual recommendations and accompanying revised fiscal note. Thank you, those who were testifying online. Next bill up is the State Employees Called to Military Duty, SB 239. We have
a little more discussion on it.
Mr. Stewart. Are you going to present this testimony? Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good morning. For the record,
morning.
My name is Dave Stewart. I'm with the Division of Personnel in the Department of Administration. It's my pleasure to speak to Senate Bill 239 this morning. In times of national emergency, the president or the governor of the state can order activation of members of the Alaska National Guard or the Alaska Naval Militia to military service. Many of those individuals are called to active duty or state employees. Routinely, state employees who are members of the Alaska National Guard are activated for training. During the two-week training leave for members of the National Guard, Army or Air Guard, or the militia, the state personnel procedures has provided for up to 16 days of paid leave to allow those individuals to be gone for training purposes. In times of emergency, however, state law limits activation by the governor or employees covered by activation of the governor to 5 days of paid leave. The additional time that they might serve is either leave without pay or through some other arrangement with their employing agency. Individuals who are called to active service by the federal government are protected by federal legislation that provides for return to employment and essentially no loss of benefit accrued by time, however, doesn't allow for or call for any supplementation of wage or continuation of benefit. The piece of legislation that you have before you, Senate Bill 239, provides for the issuance of an administrative order by the governor of the state to allow for, under certain circumstances, to be determined by those circumstances, supplementation of wage. Most members of the Army or Air Guard who are state employees who are called to active service for periods beyond the 5 days receive a military wage that may be more than or less than their state wage. This legislation would allow the governor to direct state agencies to pay the difference if their military wage is less than their state wage for a period of time. It would also allow the governor to direct state agencies to continue paying health insurance contributions or retirement system contributions for a period of time in the event that employees called active service are not covered by military benefits or will be gone for extended periods of time. A number of states across the country in response to events of September 11th have passed similar legislation or legislation close by. I believe the committee was provided with copies of this. I'm not certain if they have. If not, I can certainly provide you. Colorado, for example, recently enacted legislation allowing their governor to supplement military wages for a period of 90 days. District of Columbia allows employers to continue health insurance for the first year. There are the states and other plans that that are available. For the sake of numbers, Mr. Chairman, we monitor the current role of state employees and find that there are 189 state employees in the Army or Air National Guard. Since September 11th, 41 of those employees have been called to active service. 8 would have qualified for wage supplementation. Additionally, I think it should be noted that depending on the character of the order, character of the activation, whether that activation is federal or gubernatorial, the activated employee may be covered for health insurance by the military. There are conditions under which dependents may or may not be covered for health insurance. The cost of health insurance, and all state employees, of course, are eligible for continued benefits under federal COBRA. However, that cost can be excessive, upwards of $700 a month in some cases. The questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Were any of the 8 that would have fit into this category, were they called to active duty by the governor or by the president?
Through the chair, Senator Ward, the 8 individuals that would have qualified for supplementation, I'll pull out another sheet, were activated by the governor, but were activated on behalf of the request of the president.
Mr. Chairman, what were those 8 doing? What were the 8 doing?
As state employees, sir?
No, once they're activated, what were they doing?
I can't speak to that, so I don't know what their orders were.
Were they, Mr. Chairman, you don't know if they're like guards in a airports or something like that?
Through the chair, Senator Ward, one individual was activated for a period of 365 days. Most of them are on orders, were activated in October or December, and they're on active orders for a period of 12 months. I don't know what they're doing.
But you don't, Mr. Chairman, you don't know what they were doing, and there's only 8.
That's what he said. He didn't know what they were doing.
Is there any way we could find that out?
I suppose we could find out which agencies they work for. Mr. Chairman, Senator Ward, and ask if we have copies of their orders. I'm sure we do. I'm not certain the orders would tell us what they're doing, only that they're activated.
Deborah, do you want to come up and answer that question? I see you shaking your head. It is Deborah Garish. Would you please come up? And I noticed you had signed up to answer questions. Please state your name and affiliation for the record. Yes, certainly. Did you get his name? No, you got it? All right.
I just want to know if it's okay for it.
Anything in it?
Have all you want. It's free, except in Fairbanks.
My name is Deborah Garish. My name is Deborah Garish. I'm the wife of a warrant officer in the National Guard. And the reason I was shaking my head is the military is not very, does not like to share orders with people, what they were doing. Also, I was listening to Senator Ward, and there were actually 181 people, 189 that were called up. The eight that he was referring to are the eight where they were actually making more in state government than they were in the military. Those are the eight that he's referring to. So you have to keep that in mind. There's 189 that have been called. Most of the people that have been called up are in doing airport security and pipeline security that I know of. So do you want me to testify now? Or?
If you have further testimony, that would be fine.
Yes, I do have testimony. Like I said, I'm the wife of a warrant officer in the National Guard. The reason I'm very interested in this bill and concerned about this bill is because if my husband were called up, and I dread the day that I answered the phone and they asked for Mr. Garish, because that's the way he's called in the military, I don't look forward to that day, and there are a couple of different reasons. The main reason is the health insurance. I don't know if you guys are aware, you guys, oh well. I'm being real, right? If you're all aware that when a state employee is called up for National Guard duty, they're called up on the 25th of the month. If there's 30 days in that month, their health benefits end on the 30th of the month, period. No question. What happens in the military, unfortunately, is if you don't have orders for 180 days or more, there are no benefits for your beneficiaries. A lot of the people that were caught up in October, most of them have no benefits for the beneficiaries at all. The lieutenant colonel that I talked to at the subport is pulling his hair out because he's just trying to get medical benefits for the women and men that were caught up in October. He was so happy about 2 months ago because he was finally getting dental coverage for some of his soldiers. So basically what's happening is they're calling up National Guard folks, and there is no net to help protect their folks that they leave behind, like myself and my daughter. Another part that plays in the health insurance field is the Army does not like to cover pre-existing conditions. In my family, that presents a big problem. I'm an epileptic, I'm an asthmatic. My daughter is an asthmatic. I don't want to be put in the position of having to go, well, do I go to the hospital or do I not go to the hospital? Because I can't afford to, because we have no insurance. When my daughter has an asthma flare, she did in December, she could have very easily died. And that meant that I had to have the money to take her to the hospital. I will still take her to the hospital, but we will end up, if we have no insurance, being very far in debt. Speaking to the pay differential for myself, I'm the wife of an officer. Okay, we can live on his pay. But if I was a wife of a private or a sergeant, I couldn't live on that pay. And when somebody brings up COBRA, you have to be realistic. Even on my husband's officer's pay, there is no way that we could cover COBRA. We could cover our house, we could cover our utilities, we could cover our basic living expenses. By the way, we have no TV, no cable, so we have no extra expenses. We just live a really simple life. There is no money for COBRA. If an officer's wife doesn't have money for COBRA, The private and the sergeant's wife is certainly not going to have any money to cover COBRA.
Thank you.
And I'll take any questions you have.
Thank you, Ms. Gary, or Mrs. Gary. Any questions? Senator Wilkin?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm generally supportive of the concept. I just have some questions, three questions about the bill. The first, what is the Alaska Naval Militia? How do you qualify, and who is it recognized by?
By Mr. Stewart.
Through the chair, Senator Wilkin, the Naval Militia is recognized through the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. Who's in it? I would have to look at the statute.
How does it compare to the National Guard, which is a federal program?
It's a state program commensurate with the National Guard. I can give you no more details than that.
I'd be interested to know what that is. Certainly. And how you qualify and who recognizes it. Second, I'm concerned about, or I'm questioning the fiscal note. If these 180 people leave, or let's just use me as an example, if I'm called up and I have to go to the airport and guard the airport for 6 months, is by this fiscal note and by the statement there in the analysis, you would assume then that no one's hired to replace me, that it's just expected of each of the departments from which these folks come that the department will pick up the workload of those people that are called up. Is that what the intent of this bill is, that there'll be no replacements hired?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkin, it wasn't the intent of the bill to mandate no replacement. It was the intent of the fiscal note to indicate that given the events of September 11th and the surprise involvement, if you will, of the National Guard, there's no way to determine what the impact might be or the duration. The legislation doesn't contemplate a particular duration of activation or number of employees or the nature of the activation. So,
but I understand that, appreciate that. But by the fiscal note, is the intent then of the legislation that no one would be hired to replace one of these folks that have been called up?
Through the chair, no, sir.
Then I suggest we probably want to review the fiscal note. Third thing, what is the, I think we have to probably draw some lines as to what the trigger mechanism is for this to happen. As I understand it, it's some sort of emergency somewhere, and then the governor does an administrative order and these kick in. I think we want to make sure as the legislature that it's clearly defined when he or she does that. Yeah, so that we don't have what would amount to these being done on an individual basis. So those are my three concerns, Mr. Chairman.
Thanks, Senator Wilkin. Senator Osterman?
Yes. First off, you talked about a report that you had that talked about different states and the amount of time lapse, if I understood correctly, from 90 to 100 or to a full year. We haven't seen that. I don't have seen it. I'd like to get a copy of that. And if I understand, in reading this, I don't see anywhere in here where we've actually put a time frame on this, as you can get in the report that other states do.
Can barely hear you, Senator Osterman.
Mm-hmm.
Could you speak up, please?
I don't see anything in here that talks about a time frame for how long this can continue on. Each individual item like he reported in one of his, or that talks about in that report he has. So I'd like to see the report and potentially look at maybe an amendment for that aspect.
To the chair, Senator Osterman, the bill doesn't speak to a timeline. There wasn't one anticipated, and what I have is both a survey of the states that we conducted prior to authoring this legislation and the most recent list of individuals who have been activated or the differences in pay, which I'll be happy to provide the committee.
Senator Osterman?
Ma'am, you talked about a 180-day period. So if this bill covered the first 180 days, would that then cover the problem that you're experiencing Or C, or would it have to continue on after that?
If it covered the first 180 days, yes, it would cover the problem for the health insurance. Because once they're on orders, okay, their orders go beyond the 180 days, he's covered. However, that they get orders in the very first place, that they're going to be on for 180 days, they automatically, their dependents kick in. But what is happening, sir, is that they're rotating people out of service. They're asking for volunteers. For example, my husband's gotten 2 letters asking him to volunteer for airport security. And both times he's turned it down because there will be no health insurance for the family. And also, I'd like to speak a second. You talked about timelines. It made me think about something I forgot to say. I encourage you to please look at this and please deal with it this year. It's a long time between now and next January when you come back and start the process all over again, especially for those of us who are families that are sitting here not knowing when the phone's going to ring. And it's not a matter of if it's going to ring. It's more of a matter of when it's going to ring.
Thank you, Ms. Carey. Senator Wilkin?
Mr. Chairman, are we talking about 180 people or are we talking about 8 people?
189.
But this bill, in this case, this scenario we've had for the last 6 months, are we talking about 8 people this bill would affect?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkin, yes.
Okay, the other 181 are making more at their call-up pay than they would at their state pay. Okay, thank you.
Any other questions or comments? I want to look at the fiscal note on this, and so we'll hold it over for a day or so and deal with that later time. Thank you. Next bill up is Senate Bill number 278 regarding eminent domain. And we have someone from the sponsor's office. Could you state your name and affiliation for the record, please?
Okay. My name is Kim Augusti. I'm staff in Senator Torgerson's office. Senate Bill 278 is concerned with the eminent domain and declaration of taking proceedings in Alaska statute. The bill introduces a reasonable and diligent effort clause that attempts to place the condemner of land and the private land owner in an equal negotiating position. The bill is not trying to remove the authority of the state to take land by eminent domain or in any way complicate existing proceedings. Currently, Alaska law does not require the state to engage in a good faith effort to negotiate with private landowners. Without an incentive to negotiate, state officials are free to make only an unreasonable offer or none at all. Striving to initiate communication from a more equitable bargaining position will promote more productive negotiations, facilitate dialogue over reasonable concerns, and encourage suggestions from all parties involved. The phrase reasonable and diligent effort or similar workings have been adopted by at least 23 other states. The intent of this is to reduce the amount of litigation by encouraging more cases to be settled up front, thereby promoting expediency in government actions. Regarding any amendments to the bill, Senator Torgerson yields to the judgment of the Finance Committee. As is, the bill carries no fiscal note, but the previous renditions of the bill had an indeterminate fiscal note. Which is what brought us to the Finance Committee. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's all I have. I believe there are others to speak to the bill. If you...
Mr. Rick Kozlerich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Rick Kozlerich. I'm the state right-of-way chief. I've been working for the Department of Transportation for over 22 years as a right-of-way agent. I have here also sitting with me is Mr. Cummings with the Department of Law. I'm here today, first of all, I want to thank you very much for allowing me the opportunity to speak to you all again. I'm here today to testify against, in opposition to Senate Bill 278. I'm taking exception to the inclusion within the bill about the reasonable and diligent effort. My experience with the Department of Transportation, as I said, has been over 22 years as a right-of-way agent, is that the Department of Transportation does act in good faith to purchase property before proceeding into a condemnation situation. I believe that this bill will add additional steps in an already complex process. DOT follows various guidelines when acquiring property. The majority, or the major points are the Alaska Constitution, which says that no property should be taken without just compensation, and then there's various federal regulations that DOT follows. One of these is the Uniform Act, and this is also within the department's policies and in within the right-of-way manual. This requires that each acquisition file, in other words, every time that a right-of-way agent goes out to purchase property, that they document the procedure and the steps that they go through in purchasing the property. As the project is developed, right-of-way agents begin researching ownership and then make initial contacts to the various property owners. This is through a series of community meetings, one-on-one meetings with the property owners, and with the appraisal effort. Let me speak just a little briefly about the appraisal effort. The appraiser that is hired by the department to go out and appraise property that we acquire, the Department of Transportation acquires for the people of Alaska, we require that the appraiser gives a letter or a note of some note within the file that shows that they have tried to contact the property owner and have had some dialogue with them as far as allowing them to be in with the inspection of the property, make some type of effort to make sure that the property owner is aware of the appraisal process. This is in addition to the right-of-way agents actually going out and contacting the property owner also. Throughout the negotiation process, the right-of-way agents are in constant contact with the property owners. Every effort is made here with the property owners to reach an agreement prior to proceeding to a negotiation, or excuse me, to a condemnation situation. The right-of-way agents work to resolve issues that the property owner may have about the configuration of the project, the access, the ingress, whatever the effect that the project may have on the property. Works with the property owners on questions of valuation. Works with the property owner to relocate them if they need to be moved off the property into a new location. All of this process is a matter of record, and it goes into the departmental files. Finally, before a condemnation action is filed, the right-of-way agent and the designers, the various other people within the department, create what's called a decisional document. And what this is that this lays out for the court the process that we, the Department of Transportation, went through in negotiation with the property owner. So I offer this information to you today so that you know that the Department of Transportation, in its policies and procedures, are making a diligent effort and a reasonable effort to ensure that people that are affected by a project get all the benefits that are due them. And I'm here to answer any questions that you may have. And again, thank you very much for allowing me to speak. And I have Mr. Cummings here with the Department of Law that he may have something to add.
Mr. Cummings, do you wish to add to that, or do you just hear the questions?
I have just a few brief comments. First of all, there's extensive statutory authority that's already on the books that requires, that sets the state's negotiations practices for the acquisition of land. And I would refer you to AS 3460.120. It sets out a pretty clear requirement that we're supposed to treat folks fairly who are not buying the land. And we are pretty successful, the state is. We condemn a pretty general range, somewhere in the neighborhood of 2-5% of our acquisitions. The state is very successful in its negotiations. And it hardly, you know, when you're that successful, you know, you can't be cheating people and hoodwinking them. Finally, turning to the bill itself, you know, it's great to say for the purposes of your oversight, as you do in Section 1, you have to diligently try to negotiate and act in good faith. It's quite another thing to impose the procedural requirement upon the Superior Court. I would refer you to Sections 2 and 3. Under Section 2 in AS 955-430, it's amended to require that there be a statement that included that...
Mr. Cummings, could you speak a little louder, please?
Sure. Okay. In language proposed as subsection 8 under AS 955-430, there's a requirement that a statement be made that the state has negotiated diligently and in good faith. Okay. That's similar to the requirement that we're requiring it for, you know, for a purpose that we have the authority and necessity and it's in the Greg's public law. What happens, though, under Section 3 is that statement where we've made this diligent and reasonable effort becomes a point of litigation in the case.
Comes a point where what?
Becomes a point of litigation in the case. In other words,
I understand.
Opposing counsel get to stand up and pound on the table and say the state hasn't been fair, the state hasn't been reasonable. Look how pitifully low the offer is. What this does is elevate the valuation of the property to be the rather than being something that's done after you get possession and after you get the project underway. It elevates it to be up front, and it delays the project until you've made a pretty thorough analysis of it. And I realize you have a lot of state employees that come in here and say there's going to be a change and the sky is falling. And just let me remind you that we do have a fair amount of experience with a similar litigation pattern where we talk about the decisional document, which Mr. Kozlerich made reference to. If you get into a situation where you wind up litigating whether the state's been reasonable and has acted diligently, you're probably going to delay a project for a year because each of these parcels is definitely critical to a project and you can't proceed forward without all the right-of-way or all the land or to build your park or whatever. So, well, you know, it's a difficult thing to sit here and say, no, the state shouldn't be required to be reasonable and diligent and act in good faith. As Mr. Kozlerich indicated, the state already is. And what you're going to do with these amendments is probably engender further delay upon the projects while this relatively complex litigation proceeds forward.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Senator Osterman.
Thank you. First off, to DOT, if I understood you correctly, you already do this. I mean, you're already trying to negotiate before you do the eminent domain on a reasonable and diligent effort, right?
Through the chair, Senator, yes, that's true. We do quite extensive negotiations with property owners already.
So the fact that you're doing it already, I mean, I don't understand. You're objecting to this. But you're doing it already. It's fine.
Sir, through the chair, Senator, what I'm concerned about is, as Mr. Cummings has said, is that this will give additional delay to an already complex process and allow, in statute, a reason to further delay a project. That's my main concern. Right-of-way is on a very critical path. We've seen, for instance, on the Parks Highway, delays in a project where those delays cause the right-of-way cost to be much more than the actual construction cost, simply because of the delays that we were seeing there in the project. This is my experience of 22 years, the more litigation, the more time that the attorneys get involved in this type of situation, the more of a delay that we can have. I would invite any of the committee members to look into regional files, and you would see the effort that is put forth to reach negotiations amicably with property owners. Thank you.
Senator Wilken.
Mr. Chairman, I have in my pocket a little list of bills that I want to make sure get passed this year and those that I don't. And I'll share with you in this committee that this is a bill I want to see get passed this year. I don't understand how the state can sit here and tell us that they don't want to be reasonable and diligent, and at the same time tell us that indeed that's what they do and we don't need any oversight. Senator Torgerson, myself, didn't wake up one morning and decide to bring this bill forward. I can give you folks, and you probably are aware of those, two examples of people in Fairbanks, small business people, that for the want of a better word had been jerked around by DOT, and the heavy hand of the wealth of DOT to arrive at an amicable evaluation and settlement of their little piece of property, having to do two separate pieces of property, having to do with a road reconstruction in Fairbanks, is beyond my comprehension when it was brought to me in November of last year. In these two cases, one of which is going to trial, and I saw the documents at least in November, as far as it had gone, I looked at the numbers and I said to myself, this is embarrassing that our state, the DOT has not settled this and instead has gone forward with a very expensive, for both parties, litigation to bring this to a conclusion over a number that I'll just say is somewhere below $500,000 for the piece of property. I looked at it and I said, this has to be changed. The other case is a businessman that has been in business in Fairbanks for years, and he happens to do my survey. And I said to him, he had the same problem in November. And when I went back to get my survey in February, I said, Mr. So-and-so, I said, how's your thing going with the state? He said, well, we settled. I said, oh, you did? And he says, yeah. He says, Gary, I can't fight them. I don't have the money. So at least in those two examples that are my examples, and I think they, when I talked to Senator Torgerson about it, he had similar examples in Kenai. At least in my two examples, what you said did not apply. And that's why this bill is here, and that's why this bill, to me, is a priority bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Wilken. One of the things that I'm not sure about the bill, why we need to have this, is the in Section 2, which is Section 8 there, which except where the consent of the property is not maintained, or excuse me, not, the report on diligent effort. I understand trying to get the appraised value, but I'm not exactly sure why we want to do the extra step. And I guess the sponsor isn't here, so I'll have to save that question for him. Senator Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It implies, if I can, in the sponsor statement that by requiring a reasonable and diligent effort, that this would create a full disclosure of information. Is there any information that is not being disclosed now to anybody that's having their property taken away?
Right. Through the chair, Senator Ward, to my knowledge, that a file is all the information that's available to the right-of-way agents, also available to the property owner. What we are trying to facilitate here is an exchange of ideas and exchange of information between the property owner and the Department of Transportation. In right-of-way, we only litigate over necessity, in other words, the necessity to acquire the property. I'm concerned that this bill will require litigation over the reasonableness of our efforts also, and I'm concerned about that type of those, that type of what creates something that's reasonable. I do recognize, Senator, if I may, that people, meetings of the minds are often difficult to come to sometimes. There are cases where people may not feel that the they're getting what they deserve from the Department of Transportation, and that's why we could carry this, the process carries on to a eminent domain situation. Our job in Department of Transportation is to make sure that people are justly compensated for the acquisition of the property and also to make sure that projects are built. Senator.
Senator Wood.
Thank you. All of us have received individual things. My question is then that all material that brought the final and best offer from right away to the property owner, that's all available, is that correct?
That's true. Through the chair, Senator Ward, yes, that's true.
And if they chose to ignore a factual entity or factual circumstance and chose to ignore it, but yet the property owner did not want to ignore it, then what would happen?
Through the chair, Senator Ward, I would hope that the property owner would discuss that with the right-of-way agent and that they would somehow that there would be a meeting of the minds there. If there is an impasse, then our procedure, the procedure that the state has laid out is that eventually it will go into litigation. We recognize that if it does, as a department, if it does go into litigation and if a property owner prevails because of some something that, some value perhaps that the department has overlooked, the Department of Transportation and through the project will pay for the litigation costs for the individual. I believe that this is that the negotiations here are a give and take situation. I don't know if I did I answer your question, Senator?
As well as you can.
Thank you.
I'm going to invite Mr. Tillengast and Mr. Wolf to come up and testify.
Thank you,
gentlemen.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Tillinghast. I'm an attorney that represents Sea Alaska Corporation. Sea Alaska supports the bill. Just one quick observation. The bill is not exotic. It's the reasonable and diligent standard has been adopted by at least 23 states. It's recommended by the preeminent national expert on eminent domain, which is a fellow by the name of Nichols, which puts out this big multi-volume treatise on eminent domain. And it's also recommended by the Uniform Law Commissioners as an element of the Uniform Eminent Domain Code. And the reason that it is that this requirement is specifically designed to minimize litigation and to reduce acquisition costs. I'm just going to quote a two-sentence explanation from the Uniform Law Commissioners on the public policy behind this type of bill, because it says it better than I can say it, and I'm quoting now. The purposes of preliminary purchase attempts include the protecting of property owners from arbitrary and unexpected exercises of eminent domain power, facilitation of amicable settlements of disputes as to the amount of just compensation, minimizing acquisition costs through reduction of litigation, and promotion of citizen cooperation with governmental programs involving land acquisition. In other words, when you have a bill like this, the government tends to treat the private sector more as partners in a negotiation rather than as victims. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, if you have any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Tillinghast. Mr. Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to be brief, Sea Alaska supports this bill and the committee is on schedule, so I'm going to be silent.
Okay.
I'll answer any questions that someone may have.
Senator Osterman, do you have a question? Any other questions or comments?
I'll go to
the off-net site, we have Mr. Satterberg and Mr. Evans. Mr. Satterberg, you're up.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry I wasn't able to testify last week. I was slightly tied up. The issues that I'm concerned about here is, first of all, keep in mind, this bill is not directed at the state. I sense a certain amount of fear on the part of the state's representatives that it's directed at the state. It's not. It's a revision to the eminent domain code, which not only affects the state of Alaska, of course, but it also affects other municipalities and governmental organizations, and in fact, may even affect certain private sector interests, possibly. So I certainly wouldn't say that it's tailored to the state. The state says there's not a problem. I made a short list here of, let's say about probably about 10 cases. State of Alaska versus Lundgren, State of Alaska versus David Dahl, State of Alaska versus Phil Evans, State of Alaska versus Wayne and Virginia Clark, State of Alaska versus Deasy, State of Alaska versus Teller Native Association, State of Alaska versus Bering Straits Native Association, State of Alaska versus Guy Kasnick, State of Alaska versus Andy Bachner. And I'm sure that if you inquire, you'll find that there are a tremendous number of additional cases. Each one of these cases started out with a deposit which was very low. And then, for example, the Vesey case started out with less than $5,000 and ended up with a settlement which, as I recall, exceeded $1 million. Teller Native Corporation started out with a $1,500 deposit, settled in the several hundred thousand dollar range. State of Alaska versus Phil Evans, which is still in litigation, started out with a deposit of about, $15,000-$20,000. The master's award exceeded $200,000, and the state appealed that. The list goes on. Kasnick, Andy Bachner, similar cases, where the state has started out with very low deposits and then ends up with massive judgments against it because of the way it's handling the cases. I don't necessarily disagree with Mr. Cummings' statement that a lot of cases get settled before they go to litigation. The answer to that is very simple. People don't want to go to litigation with the state. It's too expensive. It's too time-consuming. They're told they're going to be drug into condemnation. They're spending hourly attorney's fees, which are quite expensive. And basically what the state says is we'll wait to the end of the case, and then we'll sort it all out at the end. I would suggest that what you do is audit or ask the state to produce the cases with, take a random audit of the last 4 years of cases in all the districts, not just Fairbanks, but Anchorage, Kenai, wherever. Find out what the initial deposited amount was and what the final settlement or judgment amount was, and look at the disparities. It'll amaze you. It's phenomenal. One of the problems that we have here is, for example, on the Phil Evans case, the state of Alaska will condemn a piece of property. They will put the money into the court registry. They will say it is for the benefit of the landowner. But that's not true, because what happens is that the money gets pulled out. Usually it has to go to pay down a deed of trust. It has to take care of other obligations. And it may go to pay attorney's fees, but what happens is you can't interpret it as simply a war chest. Because if there is a deed of trust, that money's going to have to go to defray that deed of trust. Secondly, the landowner spends quite often $10,000 to $15,000 in appraisal costs. And for example, in the Evans case, $40,000, the approximate amount of costs incurred by Phil Evans and his wife Linda in that condemnation case, of paid money. We're not talking about carried on account. The state of Alaska loses at the master's hearing, then appeals it, goes back to square one. And the landowner is now looking at spending another $20,000 to $30,000 in costs before they get to the end of the case, and then arrive at the position which you've heard about, which is, well, if we get to the end of the case, we'll pay them their costs and attorney's fees. Let's use some common sense here. I've been involved in this business since 1976. In fact, Mr. Cummings was one of my law clerks. The fact of the matter is that when you get to the end of the case, many of these people can't make that distance. I had suggested to Senator Taylor by email that one of the things that has to be done with this bill is it actually has to have some teeth put in it. Not only diligence, which I think is very important, I agree with John Tillinghast that, you know, that this bill should be recommended to you, but you need to put some teeth in it as well, which basically says that if the state chooses to appeal a master's award, it has to put a new deposit into court up to the amount of the master's award, And secondly, the landowner at the point of the master's hearing can ask for and receive their costs and attorney's fees that have been incurred until that point in time. 95% of the state's cases are federally funded by federal dollars, if you will. And I certainly realize that should not necessarily figure into your equation, but quite often you'll take a look at a financial note and you'll say, where are we going? Well, the fact of the matter is that if nothing else, the landowner should be given the chance to be made whole at least halfway through the case. And in addition, if the landowner is going to go out and hire an appraisal to fight the state in a condemnation case, the state of Alaska should advance to the landowner a certain amount of discretionary funding to allow them to go out and to acquire an appraisal and to acquire an attorney if necessary at that stage of the case. Finally, I would suggest that you pass some legislation that basically says the state cannot appeal a master's award, that essentially that they are stuck with it. The master's award is to be held as the final decision-making process, if you will, only if the landowner chooses to appeal, but I realize that might be going a little far. But if anything, put some financial strength in this thing so landowners aren't being terrorized the way they are right now. Unfortunately, most landowners are not hooked together in a group, a lobbying group, if you will, such as the state may have on its own side, of course, with DOT or what have you. But I'd ask that you just take a look at a number of the cases. Pick any 10 or 15 cases out of any jurisdiction that have gone to litigation and look at the difference between the deposit and the final result, and the answer will be in the numbers. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Satterberg. Mr. Evans?
His testimony, and I thank you for taking time to let me know that this was going on. I only had about 20 minutes advance notice, so I'm somewhat disorganized, but let me give you my experience. The State of Alaska Department of Transportation recently took a portion of my property to use for a road construction project. I would like to make you aware of my experience with them. Prior to the condemnation being filed, the person representing the state was courteous but misleading in attempting to convince me to accept a settlement that was completely unfair. Prior to the condemnation being filed, the state appraiser provided no meaningful information. She was quite insistent about her authority to be on my property and utilize space in a business located in the mall for her office. She was deceptively courteous and misleading in her attempt to promote an unfair evaluation of the property. The state did not provide me with a copy of their completed appraisal report and market data book. I was unable to settle with the state based on that appraisal because the compensation was totally inadequate and unfair. The appraisal did not fairly set forth the value of the taking and the consequences to the remainder property. In the appraisal of my property, the before the taking value was based on the current use of property rather than the highest and best use of the property. The following items were not fairly considered when analyzing the effects of the right-of-way taking of the property. Loss of parking, change in highest and best use, decline in market appeal, change in the business use of the property, and decline in market value. When it became apparent the state was misleading and unfair in their attempts to reach settlement, I hired an attorney and an appraiser to provide me with accurate and fair counsel. The state appraiser concluded that just compensation for the property taken and damages was $80,229. The appraiser that I subsequently hired concluded that the just compensation for property taken and damages was $676,000. That's approximately eight times the amount the state. As a consequence, we proceeded to a hearing. Frank King, an appraiser, was appointed by the state to preside over the master's hearing. At the conclusion of the hearing, Mr. King rendered a decision awarding $324,000 for property taken and damages. Although this was approximately half the amount sought, I decided rather than continue with litigation, I would settle. The state subsequently appealed. Now, my costs have been about double what Mr. Satterberg estimated, $60,000 rather than $30,000. This has been in progress since 1991. And after the master's hearing, I received a lead schedule from the Attorney General's office indicating times when it wouldn't be convenient to go to the hearing in 2002. Subsequently, I received a notice that my hearing would not be scheduled until sometime in 2003. In the meantime, I have these ongoing costs that, frankly, are hard to bear. And then after receiving these lead schedule bits of information, I also received a demand for 8 years of records. All of my income tax statements, all of my profit and loss, expenses, income, correspondence with businesses, attorneys, appraisers, 8 years of records. This took my secretary and I the better part of a week to compile. Now, strangely, I have a co-owner, Denali Alaska Federal Credit Union, in the mall. And when I talked to the vice president of our association, who's the vice president for that bank, they weren't asked for 8 years of their records, so apparently there was an oversight. I was new to all of this. I bought the mall in 95. I was contacted by the right-of-way agent shortly thereafter. I had never gone through any of this. She was very nice and I think deceptive, and the right-of-way agent who's been testifying for you is pretty much telling it as I experienced it. But see, I had no basis for knowing what to expect. Now, after reading the Senate Bill 278, my only question is what does this change? The state controls the process, condemns the land, appoints the appraiser to substantiate state established values, and when challenged, they pick a master to reside over a hearing to decide fair settlement, which they then appeal. In the meantime, they cripple the business by making it inaccessible to the public for an extraordinary period of time. Bill does suggest the landowner seek their own appraisal. This was never suggested when I was dealing with Tony, the right-of-way agent here. However, when my banker suggested I obtain an appraisal, and I did so, the state gave it no credibility. I feel the state totally takes over private property with no respect for the rights of the owner or concern for the damages they cause. There is no requirement for the state to obtain the landowner's consent to sell. The landowner is not given the option to continue to make a living using the land he bought. The state merely takes what they want, and through extensive intimidation and the pressure of continuing litigation expense, caused the property owner to fold. Interestingly, federal funds are made available for the state to pay for this land. I really don't understand. The master's hearing seemed to me to be a reasonable event, although I was somewhat dismayed at some of the tactics the state employed, but since they had appointed the master, and the master came up with a decision that was four times what the state appraiser had come up with, but half of what mine had, I thought that was something the state should look at favorably, since it was, they had appointed to make this to mediate. But I think Senate Bill 278, as Mr. Satterberg has mentioned, needs more teeth, not less. And, I respect what the state has a job to do. I just feel that the people that are being required to give up the property they worked hard and saved in order to buy need to be brought up to speed. You know, they come off without knowing anything about the process, and I think it's a very difficult position to be placed in. And I thank you all for taking time to listen.
Thank you, Mr. Evans. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like, just like to ask the last witness if he could just answer a question. As you look at Senate Bill 278, does that adequately address some of the difficulties you see with the process?
Senator Olson, I think he said that he did not. However, we do have another version that I'd like to to look at, which is the original version of the bill. In judiciary, some language was taken out, and that language that was taken out probably could add some teeth to the process.
Thank you, Mr. Ward.
Thank you. Of the last witness, and I'm not quite sure of the legal ramifications, but do you believe at the beginning of this process, if the state of Alaska